When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Matthew 16:13-16. Now it's time for Who Do You Say I Am with Father Mitch Pacwa. And now, Father Pacwa.
Hi, today we're at Loyola University campus, the place where I teach. And we have with us an expert on ecological ethics, Dr. William French. Dr. French received his doctorate in theology from the University of Chicago, not only a great university, but a university in a great city. And we'd like to introduce Dr. French today. Dr. French, a number of people have expressed concern about the ecological movement and Earth Day as something that the New Age movement has taken over and is trying to use as a way to get a one-world government to control everybody around the world. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. That's a very interesting concern. It seems to me that, one, the New Age movement first of all, doesn't have that kind of power. Also, environmental issues are so genuinely important, I think we should appreciate the efforts of any groups and any religious movements that would devote attention to that important issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there are excellent reasons for Christians and Jews to be aware and concerned about environmental issues that have to do with our traditional notion that all of nature is part of God's creation, and therefore if we love God and we love our neighbors, we are obligated to be concerned about what human industrial practices are doing to nature.
Now, Dr. French, on the other side, we have some Christians, for instance, the former Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, who, according to newspaper reports, said that we could use all the resources up in this generation because Christ's second coming is so soon that there won't be another generation.
Sure.
What kind of response would you have to that?
Well, that's a good point, but I wouldn't use one person's interpretation of the signs of the times to discredit an entire great tradition of religion.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Christianity has been appealed to legitimate apartheid in South Africa by some of the Dutch Reformed churches.
Right.
But it seems to me the better voice of Christianity in that context is really from Desmond Tutu and others who will appeal to the same tradition and the same set of biblical texts to legitimate the more traditional concerns of equality and justice. So it would seem to me, I think what you have in James Watt is a rather narrow and reductionistic interpretation of what we call in theology eschatology, an argument that you can see the inevitable coming of Christ very soon. Therefore, we will not have any future human generations to be concerned about, and that can lead to a notion that, well, why not? Let's use it up now.
Mm-hmm.
Let's live for today, and let's develop, and let's not worry about God's creation in future generations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it seems to me that's a rather an aberrant reading of our tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all sorts of other interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
As a consequence, it seems we all have a responsibility to be critical in our interpretation of biblical materials.
Now, we have two different sides then. On one hand, those New Agers who would want to have a one-world government controlling the total ecology of the world.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, people say use all the resources up because it's all going to end anyway.
Right.
What would be a more middle approach and sensible approach for Christians to take?
It seems to me the center of the Christian tradition is love of neighbor, love of creation.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires pragmatic, responsible assessments of what the problems are that we face. And therefore, Christians cannot afford naive thinking. Now, in some senses, I appreciate creative thinking today about how the nation states do, as entities, have trouble dealing with transnational or transcultural problems. Right. It seems to me we have footsteps in this century of a feeble attempt to develop international organizational bodies. We all appreciate the role of the United Nations.
Right. Now, the World Oceans.
The World Oceans.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Chernobyl, the nuclear accident in the Soviet Union, showed us that one nation's accident today can spread radioactive strontium-90 worldwide. The Norwegian dairy industry has been greatly damaged, and reindeer herds had to be killed because of the radioactivity caused by one national incident.
Right.
That does suggest that ecological problems are foundational and shared by all nations. Also, I think we need to remember that the nation state as an entity is a relatively recent human invention, originating after the city-state, after the empire models, relatively recently in the 15th century. It seems to me we are entering into a period of global economic integration, of global transportation and instantaneous communications. I think it's unrealistic to expect an instant jump to world government. That ignores traditions of integrity within cultures.
Also, you have a tension even within some nations that are composed of subunits of breaking apart, that people want to have their autonomy respected, and at the same time we deal with the tension of working on this environment that crosses international borders.
That's right.
So we're dealing with a tension there that we have to work with and be creative with.
That's right. It seems to me also the naivete on the other hand of the notion that we will not have future generations, therefore let's have a party and develop the earth, is highly irresponsible, that Christian prudence should dictate that we carefully analyze the problems we face.
A friend of mine was a missionary in northern India among tribal people, and these folks thought that the world was going to end because Skylab was going to fall the next day. So they killed all their goats, ate them up, and they told the priest that, and he said, oh, my God won't let it end tomorrow, and they said, oh, that's very interesting, we'll see. And they both, all their matter of fact about the whole thing. The next day the world didn't end, and the tribal people came to him and said, well, I guess your God was right. Maybe we should become Christian soon. The whole village became Christian as a result. If you'd come back in just a moment, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. French. To continue our discussion with Dr. William French. Dr. French, would you continue giving us your reflections on that common sense approach toward ecological ethics for Christians?
Yeah, you mentioned some of the naivete of thinking that the world will be ending, or trying to generate our policies or the way we act in life with a sense that the world's going to end in 20 years,
right.
Therefore we need not worry about these ecological issues. To me, that's simply irresponsible. I'm intrigued with the way the Jewish and Christian heritage has emphasized we have duties of hospitality to strangers, or we have also the duty to protect our neighbors. That one of the quintessential texts, the Good Samaritan story, where our innocent neighbor is identified and responded to with care. We need to understand and broaden our sense of where our innocent neighbors are in an ecological era. For instance, we typically think of our innocent neighbors as within our generation. but do we not need to understand that the Christian church is an intergenerational community, that we would not be speaking the theological languages, we would not be speaking the English language if we did not have a great debt that we inherited from our ancestors, and that sets up incumbent upon us certain responsibilities to care for our future posterity.
Now, does this apply also to poor nations that can't afford to deal with ecological issues?
Absolutely. The expansion of the neighbor concept, it seems to me, traditionally it hasn't been shifted across to think about non-human species. Mm-hmm. But Albert Schweitzer certainly is an example of a Christian theologian who felt that all life forms have a sacredness to them because they're created by God. And as the Genesis text says, God saw that it was good.
So the principle then is that God is the one who created the world, not that the world is God, and that we're concerned more that God loves the creation that he made.
Right. We see in the Old Testament a number of different images for the relationship of humanity to nature. Mm-hmm. We have the dominion theme that emphasized humanity's superiority and role of to use nature. It was perfectly accepted that we have a valid claim to use nature for our benefit. But that's not the only word. We also have strict duties of obligation owed to our animals and to the rest of the earth. Mm-hmm. Now that becomes, in an era of weak technology, that's not all that critical an issue, and therefore it was never on the top burner of the oven of Christian ethics.
But what do you mean by weak technology?
Relatively benign technologies. For example, in my own personal life, I grew up on in a woods near the next door to the farm owned by my grandfather. Mm-hmm. He was a dairy farmer. We lived outside the Washington, D.C. area. 2 years after his death, ground was broken on that dairy farm for a federal scientific research center with a radiation physics lab, and so they developed a nuclear reactor on that. By relatively benign technologies, I mean the technologies that the human race had, we could do some technological damage to nature.
So the waste left behind by the cows has a shorter life than the waste left behind by the nuclear research.
Biodegradable.
Yeah. Right.
And it has a much shorter half-life.
Right.
That the half-life of cow manure is, after a few rains, it's gone.
Right.
The half-life of plutonium, we're talking about 10,000 years.
Okay. So benign and weak technology would be that which fits into the environment more easily.
Correct. What we have is a massive shift in the Industrial Revolution to different types of human productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, a vast increase of human power.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the 17th century, we never needed to worry about the Amazon jungle because we could accept that it was so vast and it was simply a given.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we've developed technologies, and there are lots of economic reasons that are providing incentives for the development of the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly in the 20th century, we have to recognize that lots of natural entities and ecosystems that we once were not moral concerns because they weren't threatened, now with the rise of 20th century technologies in military hardware, in the whole petrochemical industry, we have a whole new range of ethical concerns.
So it's not like what we see in Psalm 104, where at night the animals like the lions come out and other dangerous animals, but when the sun goes up, they go to bed and humans come out. And only humans that are dumb enough to go out when the lions, the tigers, and the bears and the lions are out there, they're going to get hurt by the environment. But otherwise, we can cooperate with the environment.
That's an interesting point. I think it illustrates some of the changes that I'm trying to get us to look at, that it's quite understandable that ancient people and medieval people would have images of lions or wolves as threatening to them because in their environment a wolf could carry off a child, and they occasionally did. So we developed traditions of regarding certain animals as vicious and violent, almost malevolent,
mm-hmm.
and we packed into the imagery lots of junk. And now, though in the 20th...
What?
Well, predators are not malevolent. They don't have evil and nasty intentions.
Yeah,
the God created them to eat flesh.
Right, it's their instinct.
That's their instinct, and they are doing what they do. And we symbolize them. Often we have theological traditions of depicting the beast as a kind of origin of sinfulness, as if there's a beast in the human. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is our imagery of the beasts has gotten twisted historically. In the 20th century, we now have people doing careful field studies of the mountain gorillas, or careful field study of the wolves. Mm-hmm. And our whole perception has changed, both because we find the behavior of the wolves and the mountain gorillas so far more socially complex, but in addition, we know in the back of our minds that, I don't know how they do it, but the census studies of the mountain gorillas along the Zaire-Rwanda border suggest there are only 240 of them left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one era would depict the mountain gorilla kind of through the imagery of King Kong, a threatening, hostile, elemental force.
Right.
In the 1990s, our image of the mountain gorilla is a precious, threatened species.
Very vulnerable to us.
Completely vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And it generates a whole different sense of care and concern.
We have to take a break for a moment. So if you just hold on, we'll be right back. To welcome you back to our discussion on ecological ethics with Dr. William French. Dr. French, would you like to continue where you left off?
Yeah, what you have, the Catholic Church has had a strong emphasis on lots of different moral problems.
Right.
And you have a certain amount of moral capital, and you speak about certain moral issues mm-hmm. that are burning. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church in recent years is beginning to grow in awareness of the importance and the central theological importance of the ecological issues. The most recent papal encyclical on social encyclical on social concern has the current Pope John Paul II.
Okay.
It just came out last year and is the first papal social encyclical in any sustained way to address some of these ecological concerns. Mm-hmm. More recently, in a World Day of Peace message, mm-hmm. Peace with All Creation.
When was that?
That came out at the January 1st of this year.
Okay, so January 1st, 1990.
Right.
Okay.
The Pope there picks up his theme of solidarity that he's used to good effect with solidarity with the poor, mm-hmm. solidarity with all people.
Mm-hmm.
He's emphasized the importance of the solidarity within the human family of first world affluent nations with the third world poorer nations. Mm-hmm. But he's now taking that concept and suggesting that there's a wider sphere of solidarity that we have to be sensitive to, namely our solidarity with all of God's creation. He notes there that ecological concern and awareness is growing because of the vast detrimental impact we are increasingly having on the planet. He notes, for example, the ozone depletion problem, mm-hmm. the problem of the greenhouse effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so he and the Vatican are beginning to develop a greater sensitivity to this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're also being spurred by lots of Catholics and Christians, individual theologians who have been writing on these issues for some
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
A very important pastoral letter has come out of from the Filipino bishops
uh-huh.
because there they are seeing the vast impact upon their mountainous jungle regions by logging operations coming in who are just really doing serious damage to the local traditional ecology as well as the native peoples who are dependent upon the jungle ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the Pope in On Social Concern notes that in 1979 he made St. Francis of Assisi the official patron saint of all those concerned about ecology. So it seems to me that's a reminder to all Catholics especially that ecological concern is not at all simply a New Age concern.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, the life of St. Francis is a great illustration how the Catholic Middle Ages always emphasized that the human was part of God's greater creation.
As I recall, too, in the Middle Ages, the Church required farmers to have fallow ground mm-hmm. so that even the land got a Sabbath. Every 7 years, there were plots of land mm-hmm. set apart that they would not work on so they could give it a rest. And that was not only based on what we see in the Old Testament and religious requirements, but it was something that ended up being very good for the environment as well.
Right. Now, that's a good point, that we have capacities and it's permissible for Christians to use the land and the animals,
mm-hmm.
but there are limits to that use. It makes all the difference in the world to use something with an eye towards the continuation of that species in existence,
mm-hmm.
to use something with reverence and care, or to go in and clear-cut a forest.
One form of extremism in the New Age is the deep ecology movement, where they consider the trees and the bugs to have as much priority as human beings to be on this planet. Would you like to comment on that?
Seems to me that's a very callous view. Also, I think it's...
By me or them?
No, by me.
Oh, you father.
That it... the to equate the value of a human being with the value of an earthworm,
yeah.
to me, seems to be a remarkable ethical and religious reduction mm-hmm. going on. And I doubt that they practice that within their own family life,
mm-hmm.
that I imagine any of them would also think about using vaccine or penicillin to save their child from a bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So we do make choices and we set priorities. It does seem to me, though, that I think the term deep ecology has shifted over a number of years,
mm-hmm.
and I think what you're describing is a very radical edge mm-hmm. of the deep ecology movement. It seems to me deep ecology as a term initially meant a concern for nature in and of itself,
mm-hmm.
not just looking at we should preserve nature because future generations
right.
will enjoy seeing bald eagles.
Right. That's almost nature as a museum piece.
Nature as a commodity or a resource.
Right.
You can take a human self-centered ethic and add ecological sensitivity to generate a self-interested ethic for preserving our commodity base. But deep ecology wanted to say that approach is too shallow.
Mm-hmm.
We are not going to break out of our understanding that only the human has intrinsic value. Everything else is simply a thing. They found it obscene to describe a dolphin as simply a thing to be used or consumed. Therefore, they were trying to suggest that we need to understand that value runs deeper beyond just the human sphere, but that we need to explore ideas like animals do have some value independent mm-hmm. of their human, mm-hmm. of the human usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I think it was a claim about the depth of value in nature. Albert Schweitzer again, that all life forms have value. To me, he's a good deep ecologist.